With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning for your agriculture news. Today is Monday, October 23rd. Coming up in today's show, the California Small Farm Conference is happening in Stockton next week. We'll tell you what you can expect there. But first, Taylor Hillman talks with California Farm Bureau President Paul Winger about fires and defensible space.
At the California Association of Pest Control Advisors annual conference last week, California Farm Bureau President Paul Winger said although he, of course, is saddened by the fires in Northern California and the effects they're having on agriculture, he wasn't too worried about the industry because of its ability to overcome obstacles. And instead, the concern is of general well-being.
Some of our folks in the county farm bureaus, everybody's still trying to assess and to make sure they can get these fires under control first before we start assessing the damages. We know it's just going to be huge, but up until this point, we're just over a week to see, you know, just what had happened in these areas, you know, Napa, Sonoma, and spreading from there. And so there's going to be time for the assessments. In agriculture, people pull together when people are in need. We're a resilient group of people. I don't worry so much about agriculture. I worry about a lot of those people that are in those subdivisions, a lot of people that haven't been located yet that will probably be fatalities. And so just a devastating thing.
Winger, also a volunteer firefighter, said like in agriculture, environmental group agendas often hinder some practices that may have aided this disaster.
Unfortunately, we need to make sure and fight back now and let people know. Climate change or not climate change in the dialogue, there should have been defensible space put in places that wasn't. And a lot of times it's government and the environmental groups that are hindering our ability to really put in defensible space. That has to stop.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Debbie Stabenow, the ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee, wants to defend the farm bill from possible budget cuts that could come during the budget reconciliation process, which got started last week. Politico's Morning Ag Report says she filed an amendment that's intended to keep all farm bill programs away from any spending reductions from 2019 to 2028. The move is seen as mostly symbolic, coming as the Senate gets ready to consider the GOP budget resolution, which would pave the way for tax reform. The Senate's budget resolution spares the Ag Committee from having to come up with cuts, while the House resolution calls for $10 billion in cuts over the next 10 years. Those two measures will have to be reconciled. As we write the farm bill, Stabenow says, we need to send a message to our farmers, families, and rural communities that they are not on the chopping block for cuts. This amendment protects farm programs from harmful budget cuts. She says the amendment also helps protect America's land and water, as well as invest in the country's farmers and small towns. In many areas of the country, it's not too late to plant new grass seed. In fact, fall is usually better than spring for that. Gary Crawford has this seedy story.
Well, I guess it's time to pull out the songs about fall again.
When an early autumn walks the land.
Okay, hold it right there. She's singing about an early autumn, but this year, in many areas, fall weather's been late. But just in the last few days, some places finally have experienced some actual cool fall-like weather. And of course, for many of us, fall means just raking the leaves. We are inspired, though, to do other work on the lawn in the springtime. But one expert says if you have cool season grasses like bluegrass or tall fescue, when fall comes,
that grass really breaks dormancy and takes off and starts growing. It's a great time to get in there and do some work.
Dennis Patton is a Kansas State University Extension Lawn and Garden expert, and he says fall is the preferred time to do three things that most of us try to do in the springtime.
Fertilization be one. Here again, the lawns are hungry after the long, hot, dry summer. Two would be if we've got some thin or dead spots, get in there and overseed or reseed the lawn. And the third practice that's really great done in the fall is something called core aeration or aerating your lawn, which removes plugs of soil about the size of a finger out of the lawn that then helps repair the soil, loosens, breaks up the soil, also helps water nutrients move down into the soil for a healthy root.
Now today we focus on seeding or overseeding.
Seeding is an art and a science.
Mostly though a science. Patton says if you seed in the fall, you have a much better chance of getting a really good stand of grass, but not if you make a lot of mistakes.
I think the most common mistake people make is they don't properly prepare the soil.
Patton says do not just go out and throw out some seed on the ground and expect results. You have to first get that ground ready.
Make sure we get good seed soil contact. contact. And that is usually done with a process called VertiCut or VertiCutting. And what this VertiCut does, it's a machine you can rent or hire someone to do, and it slices small grooves down into the soil that breaks through that soil crust in that thatch layer, and then it allows for that seed to fall down into those grooves. Then when we start watering, we get good seed soil contact, which in turn then lead to better germination.
So next we talk about watering, very important, not just a couple of times a week either.
Because our goal is to keep that upper inch or so of the soil moist at all times during the germination process, which is probably going to take a minimum of a week to 10 days to 2 weeks, depending on the type of seed and your soil condition.
Finally, Dennis Patton recommends what's called starter fertilizer, which has more phosphorus.
Because there is scientific research to back up that a little free phosphorus right around that germinating seed will help increase root development and growth.
So do a good seeding job now so your yard won't look seedy like mine does come springtime. And your newly planted grass will be much better able to handle the stress that'll come with the hot summer weather. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Control weeds from the start with the proven long-lasting power of Chateau Herbicide SW. Chateau controls more than 90 annual broadleaf and grass weeds in orchards and vineyards, including marestail, fleabane, mallow, and more. Unlike the competition, Chateau can be applied to non-bearing orchards and vineyards after planting for early protection. Take control and keep control of tough weeds with Chateau Herbicide. To learn more, talk to your PCA or visit valent.com/chateau. Always read and follow label instructions.
Mark your calendar for October 27th to attend the free South Valley Nut Conference and Trade Show at the Tulare County Fairgrounds from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. Seminars will focus on critical orchard management topics exclusively for the almond, pistachio, and walnut industries. CE credits will be available and a free tri-tip lunch will be provided. Visit WCNGG.com online to see the full agenda and pre-register for a chance to win a free John Deere gun safe. Don't miss out on the South Valley Nut Conference hosted by West Coast Nut Magazine on October 27th at the Tulare County Fairgrounds.
Step right up and gaze upon this miraculous substance I hold in the palm of my hands. This little miracle can feed us, clothe us, give us clean, fresh water, and provide wildlife habitat for nature's critters. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the greatest soil on earth.
Learn more about soil health principles that can turn your soil into a star performer. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today to find out how. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
AgNet West Radio Network.
The House Budget Committee has voted 22-14 along party lines.
Your trusted agriculture news provider for the state of California. AgNet West's team of Sabrina Hill.
As crews continue to fight the Detweiler fire in Mariposa County.
Brian German.
Weedy rice has been a growing concern for California farmers.
And myself, Taylor Hillman. Join us every day to stay up to date with the latest agriculture news from AgNet West Radio Network and online at agnetwest.com.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's Brian German.
There is still time to register for the 2017 California Small Farm Conference happening October 29th and 30th in Stockton. The two-day event includes workshops, field courses, and networking opportunities, and typically draws over 300 attendees. Sunday will feature off-site field courses on topics including conservation that works, post-harvest handling, and sediment and erosion control plans. There will also be on-site short courses offered, as well as exhibits and a networking reception. Monday will be devoted primarily to workshops covering topics like food safety, agritourism, and farm finance networking. Registration is still available online, along with a complete list of events and workshops. The 2017 California Small Farm Conference is taking place on Sunday, October 29th and Monday, October 30th at the Robert Cabral Agricultural Center in Stockton. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
U.S. dry pea, lentil, and pulse acreage has expanded in recent years thanks to risk management-based tools and education for growers. Rod Bain reports.
We have had explosive growth in the pulse industry. And by pulses, I define them by peas, lentils, chickpeas, and dry beans.
And according to Tim McGreevy of the U.S. Dry Pea and Lentil Council and American Pulse Association, part of that growth stems from increased risk management options for these producers, particularly in the realm of crop insurance.
These risk management tools, including both a yield option for our producers and a brand new revenue protection option for peas, lentils, and chickpeas, has really made a huge difference in terms of having growers comfortable with taking the risk to grow these specialty crops on their farms.
So to put the expansion of Pulse acreage into context,
we had about 400,000 acres of peas, lentils, and chickpeas in 1995. And you fast forward to 2016, and we have now almost 2.6 million acres of those peas, lentils, and chickpeas planted in the United States.
1 year later, an additional 100,000 acres of pulse crops were planted, increasing the total acreage to over 2.7 million. McGreevy says in addition to traditional dry pea and lentil regions like the Pacific Northwest, it has been the expansion of these crops into new areas in the northern tier of the U.S. that has led to increased acreage.
We've seen expanded acreage in North Dakota early in the 2000s, and now more recently we've seen this huge explosion in acreage of these crops in Montana where they have never been raised before.
Tim McGreevy says in addition to crop insurance, grants from USDA's risk management agency utilized in the realm of education have been important for not only existing pulse crop growers, but especially for new and beginning farmers.
It's given us an opportunity to really educate these growers on how to raise these crops and how to manage the risk on these crops, how to market these crops so they feel comfortable in raising them and what markets they're actually shooting for.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Well, in today's livestock news, the Beef Checkoff continues its nutritional research efforts, and a new study indicates consumers need to keep beef on their menu. Dr. James Hill, director of the Colorado Nutrition and Obesity Center at the University of Colorado Health Science Center, says that new checkoff-funded nutrition research called the Beef Wise Study, which stands for Weight, Improvement, Satisfaction, and Energy, shows that lean beef can help people lose weight while maintaining lean muscle and supporting heart health.
People come to us with questions, and one of the questions they've always had is, well, I read that maybe I shouldn't eat beef. Well, we had always been recommending beef because we have a high-protein diet, but we thought, well, that's worth looking at. So let's actually do a study to see, in fact, if eating beef or not eating beef makes a difference with weight loss.
He says the study shows you would still lose the same amount of weight while eating beef.
We took 120 people, which is quite a few people, and we randomized them to two groups. They both went through the same weight loss program for 16 weeks. In one case, they ate beef, and in the other case, they had no beef, no lean red meat. And what we found, our hypothesis going into it, is there would be no difference. We didn't think there would be a difference. And we found exactly the same weight loss on both diets. So the answer is, whether you eat beef or don't eat beef makes no difference in weight loss. If you enjoy beef, it's perfectly fine to eat beef during weight loss.
Dr. Hill says the research findings are very positive news.
The secret to the weight loss is actually being able to make and sustain behavior changes. We can give people a diet, but it's sticking with that diet. And that's actually one of the reasons why we think it's important to look at this, because oftentimes during weight loss, we're asking people to do things that are kind of difficult for them to do, to exercise, to eat a little bit less. But eating beef's not hard to do. In fact, people like eating beef. So finding out that eating beef fits very well into a weight loss program is a really good thing, both for us and the people going through weight loss.
If you'd like more information about your beef checkoff investment, just simply visit mybeefcheckoff.com. And speaking of beef, opening new markets for U.S. beef exports continues to be a top priority for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. In export news, last week, NCBA delegation joined counterparts from around the world at the annual meeting of the International Beef Alliance in Paraguay, where they discussed strategies to increase global market access for beef. Closer to home, the fourth round of NAFTA talks wrapped up last week with little reported progress on contentious issues. The U.S., Canada, and Mexico agreed to extend the talks into early 2018. And Vice President Mike Pence met with Japan's Minister of Finance as part of the U.S.-Japan Economic Dialogue. No announcements related to Japanese tariffs on U.S. beef were made following the session, but NCBA encourages both sides to find a long-term solution and move forward with a bilateral trade agreement as quickly as possible. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Home-raised chicken is becoming fashionable practically everywhere. Some have pens with a whole flock of chickens. Others have just a few who scratch in the yard and the flower bed. It does save on the food bill, but a warning from the nation's top health officials, it could be dangerous. It could cause salmonella. It has happened. The advice is if you have or you own chickens, don't handle them. Salmonella can be fatal. 961 people have died from it this year already. That's more than all of 2016. It's more than home-raised chickens, but they can play a part in it. So if you have pet chickens or you're raising them as a way to save money, don't handle them. The slightest chance of them causing salmonella isn't worth what you save, even if they do taste better. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Griner, AgNet West.
Coffee is enjoying a huge resurgence in popularity. On this edition of Agriculture USA, Gary Crawford presents some perspectives on the prices we are paying for coffee these days.
With the incredible growth and spread of coffee shops around the country, more and more of us are drinking more and more coffee.
So won't you join me now? It's time that we take a cup of coffee. It's called a coffee break.
Yes, specialty coffees, high quality coffees, are catching the interest of consumers in an increased way.
So much so that we seem willing to pay a lot more for our coffee, at least at the big-name coffee shops. I'm Gary Crawford, and coming up on this edition of Agriculture USA, we're brewing up a cup of coffee facts and fancies.
It's called a coffee break.
You've got 2,000 green coffee beans in every pound of coffee.
Well, that's David Robinson, a coffee grower from Tanzania in Africa. He has joined with other small producers to raise high-quality Arabica coffee. Some might consider it and other coffees high-priced as well, but he says an incredible amount of work goes into that coffee. First, as you heard, in every pound, 2,000 green coffee beans.
Each of those beans had to be picked by hand and go through an extensive series of processes, transported on ox cart from the fields, trucks to the curing factory, train to the coast, ship to the U.S. It's a very labor-intensive, distant product.
Which explains some of the pricing of a pound of coffee, and, of course, if you buy it at a specialty coffee shop.
You're paying for real estate, you're paying for ambiance, you're paying for marketing. It's a quality of life decision, and people seem to enjoy it. So we credit Starbucks with enhancing people's recognition of quality coffee and having people have a willingness to pay more for it.
$12 to $15 a pound, sometimes more. And at some shops, one cup can run you $4 to $6. And now, prepare for a time traveler shock.
I love coffee. I love tea. I love the Java Jive, and it loves me. Shoot me a pot, and I'll pour me a shot. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Now, in 1940, when this song was a hit, it might have played on a jukebox in this little coffee shop, and you might have heard this exchange.
I want a cup of coffee.
Okay, Mr. Black.
Just a cup of coffee.
That will be 20 cents, please.
20 cents for two cups of coffee, 10 cents a cup, jumping Java. Batman, look what we're paying today, you may say. And so you think coffee prices are outrageous today, even to buy a pound of coffee to brew at home? But be prepared to be a little surprised at the results of a little study done by Agriculture Department analyst Anne Marie Coons. She compared the current average price of a 12-ounce cup of coffee made at home to the price when this song was a hit.
Shake down, break down, take
1987. Using the average cost of a pound of coffee, all types, all prices, cost for us to brew a cup of coffee at home in 1987, 12.2 cents. Cost today, yeah, 19.1 cents, so about 7 cents higher.
But then if we take 1987 and adjust that cost for inflation, it brings it up to 26.3 cents.
So actually, today's cup of coffee costs about 7 cents less than 30 years ago. But of course, Anne-Marie was using the average retail price of a pound of ground coffee, the average of the cheap coffees and the super expensives. And those prices over the years are all over the map. In November 2012, the average pound of coffee was selling for over $6. The average this year, about $4.50. However, some people do pay a lot more. We caught up with another coffee grower, importer, importer and expert, Arondo Holmes, at a farmer's market. He sells his bags of coffee grown on his farm in Honduras, roasted here locally by him for about $12 to $13 a pound. But no matter what you pay, you do want to get the best quality out of that coffee, and Arondo gave us some advice on how to get the best taste for your coffee dollars first.
Buy the coffee like you're buying bread. Get just enough for a week. But if you've got to have extra reserve coffee, because coffee people don't like to run out of coffee, freeze it.
In an airtight container, it'll stay in good condition for how long?
3 months.
But unfrozen, just left in the bag, Arondo Holmes says the coffee will be at peak flavor for only about 3 days after it's roasted.
So after 3 days, you've got it as good as it's going to get. And a week after that, it's going to drop off.
Arondo says if you buy a pound of coffee any kind, you can help preserve the good quality by doing whatever you can to keep the air away from it. Coffee reacts to oxygen, and the result over time is less quality. So once you open that bag and use some of it, put the rest in an airtight container immediately. And this has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
It's called the coffee break.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Control weeds from the start with the proven long-lasting power of Chateau Herbicide SW. Chateau controls more than 90 annual broadleaf and grass weeds in orchards and vineyards, including marestail, fleabane, mallow, and more. Unlike the competition, Chateau can be applied to non-bearing orchards and vineyards after planting for early protection. Take control and keep control of tough weeds with Chateau Herbicide. To learn more, talk to your PCA or visit valent.com/chateau. Always read and follow label instructions.
When it comes to a healthy bottom line for your farming operation, nothing helps like healthy soil. Producers who use soil health management systems report lower input costs while maintaining or even improving their yields. Plus, those systems help with drought protection and soil and water conservation. Contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today to find out more and unlock the secrets in your soil. This message brought to you by the NRCS and this radio station.
Mark your calendar for October 27th to attend the free South Valley Nut Conference and Trade Show at the Tulare County Fairgrounds from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. Seminars will focus on critical orchard management topics exclusively for the almond, pistachio, and walnut industries. CE credits will be available and a free tri-tip lunch will be provided. Visit WCNGG.com online to see the full agenda and pre-register for a chance to win a free John Deere gun safe. Don't miss out on the South Valley Nut Conference hosted by West Coast Nut Magazine on October 27th at the Tulare County Fairgrounds.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our technical skills.
Our math. Our engineering skills.
You're going to need our help with your water. Your air. Your food.
You're going to need our organizational skills, our problem-solving skills.
You're going to need our determination, our honesty, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise, we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West, and now more of the agriculture stories you'll want to know today. Our Taylor Hillman caught up with the Bayer team at CAPCA's annual conference. Bayer is launching a new campaign that will help smaller producers identify how they're being sustainable.
My name is Nevada Smith. I'm based in Sacramento, California, and I'm the Western Region Marketing Manager for Horticulture.
So we're talking today about a new campaign you guys have going on. What is it, and briefly, what's it about?
It's called the Grow On campaign, about sustainability for growers. One thing that's unique about the sustainable measure, this tool we're offering to growers to use, is it's a platform for mid-sized growers to even smaller growers to begin to talk about how they're sustainable in their own production practices. Not just producing crops, but maybe identifying ways in which they can communicate their story to the marketplace. We broke them into sort of six different categories. One focused around water, which is obviously very important when we talk about the state of California, labor, coming in dire needs every year, prices and issues we're facing there. Other things like greenhouse gases, soil health. How does that soil health affect the environment around you, your people next to you, biodiversity, as well as food waste. What happens to the grocery, the commodity once it's produced? Where does it go from there? Food waste is around 24 to 25%, I think, annually, what's lost. And we talk about a hungry world. Well, we need to start really tackling some of these initiatives.
And like you had a good example when we were talking about this was, you know, a wine grape grower on the coast that's in a sustainable program knows how they're being sustainable. But how does Central Coast citrus grower know? And I think that's the idea of this, is it shows you growers that they may be doing some things, and they need to identify that.
Exactly. So I think one thing nice about this is too often we'll have a approach for all vegetable crops. Well, what we really got into is leaf vegetables, and what happens to the leaf vegetable guy? What is he doing today? How's he using Movento from Bayer, and how's that really a sustainable IPM practice, and what does that really mean to him, and how can he promote that? And the citrus guy is different, as well as the tree nuts. So we have six of these today, focused on the horticulture crops categories, and it allows a platform for them to take it further and to be able to tell their story in a way and to expound upon the opportunities. We think this is also a way that you can get better commodity opportunities. How do you know that grocer that wants to buy your products? Well, tell them a little bit of a story. What are you doing for your water measures? Quite honestly, I was surprised when I visited my own family farm, brother-in-law, and they grow grapes. I said, look at all the things you're doing. You have some biodiversity. You have plantings for vertebrates, birds. I said, those are things you need to talk about with your people buying your crop.
And you know, hopefully that some growers see some stuff they aren't doing on here and look into it, right?
Exactly. And I think, and we have our commercial business advisor team, as well as our field sales team, that are reaching out to channel distribution partners, as well as telling the story. Say, if people are looking to make a platform, these are some ideas to start with. And there's other things from other companies out there that you can add, whether it be fertility programs, drone applications, how you're monitoring using drones, technologies out there to help you tell your story better.
Sustainable is such a key buzzword right now, and there's a lot of different definitions for sustainable, but this is kind of an all-encompassing thing on how you look at everything and kind of getting growers say, hey, here's what you're looking for in this, right?
Yes, I think it's maybe don't go out and do something new today. Let's see if you're a citrus producer, take this document, this tool, and see where you're hitting and not hitting, and see what maybe platforms you want to go to in the future, or which one you want to enhance more. I think that's where I'd start with this tool as.
So if growers want to find out more, they don't have one of these, where can they go to find out more?
The Bayer US website, as well as their local Bayer reps.
And ask about Grow On.
Hurricane Irma wreaked havoc on Florida in early September, hitting the state's agriculture economy especially hard. Ricky Telg, professor of agricultural education and communication at the University of Florida in Gainesville, says the damage is still being tallied up over a month later.
The preliminary assessment is $10.5 billion in damage to the Florida industry, Florida agriculture industry, with the citrus growers and nurseries suffering the biggest losses. And that was as of 2 weeks ago, and that was just the initial assessment. So the Commissioner of Agriculture is expecting to see even greater economic losses when they account for the loss of future production and the cost to rebuild infrastructure related to Hurricane Irma. So it's not a good situation. I mean, the article that ran on October the 6th shows that over 46,000 acres of greenhouse, nursery, and floriculture production was affected.
Damages to the Florida cattle industry total $230 million. The Florida dairy industry damage estimates are $12 million. Irma hit agriculture all across the state, while damages were especially bad in central and southern Florida. Citrus growers have bounced back from hurricane damage in the past. However, they were hit by a double whammy of Irma and citrus greening, which will make recovery even more challenging.
I know that in past hurricane situations that the Florida ag industry has bounced back. It's just that especially with citrus, with this coupled with citrus greening, it's going to be a difficult recovery for the citrus growers who are already suffering from citrus greening.
Citrus greening, of course, Wang Long Bing, is a disease that can affect a tree's productivity, causing it to produce smaller and discolored fruit, and eventually killing the trees. Overall, the timing couldn't have been worse for the Florida citrus industry.
It's a winter produce state. So, you know, up in the Midwest and upper Midwest, most of the harvesting goes on during, you know, late spring and through the summer into early fall. I mean, in Florida, a lot of the produce is from January-ish through May, that cycle when there's not a lot of produce happening in other places of the country other than like Texas and California. So the citrus producers were getting a lot of their fruit on the tree, and Irma came through and knocked a lot of it down.
Citrus losses are estimated at $761 million. Telg said the trickle-down effect of the economic loss will be felt throughout all of Florida's rural communities. Dairy operations in Puerto Rico are running out of feed, but USDA has just announced a new program to help get feed to those operations. Gary Crawford reports.
Puerto Rico's 253 licensed dairy operations are trying to keep operating using power from generators as hurricane recovery continues. One problem, though, becoming critical.
The lack of feed, the lack of hay to provide to the milking cows.
That's Carlos Suarez. He's coordinating from San Juan all of the U.S. Department of Agriculture recovery operations and programs in Puerto Rico. The newest one just announced, aimed at helping Puerto Rican dairy operators get feed for the approximately 94,000 dairy cows on the island. Starting then this Saturday,
producers will receive vouchers to go to the three main feeding vendors here in the island and get access to feed from those vendors.
And no worries.
The vendors do have the feed available, and they have been working very diligently with us to make sure that this program runs as smoothly as possible to assist producers that need it the most.
Producers will be applying to USDA's Farm Service Agency to get the vouchers, which will be good for about a month's worth of feed. USDA providing up to $12 million for this dairy assistance effort. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.